Hi, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your newest host, Ann Hillman, a behavioral health provider and a former journalist. Identity Inc. was one of the oldest LGBTQ plus serving organizations in Alaska until it closed its doors in May of this year. They began providing support for gay men in the 1970s, then grew to be one of the main providers of queer-focused healthcare in the state. Today on Line One, we'll be talking about what the closing of Identity means for Alaskans and their healthcare. And before the guests introduce themselves, I want to let listeners know that this is a pre-recorded show, so you won't be able to call in or email with your questions. So first, Liz, could you introduce yourself, please, and tell us how you're linked to Identity?
Sure. My name is Liz Petralzik. I'm a family physician, and I practice in Alaska. I started with Identity in November of 2025 as the medical director. So I started providing care there then. Started as a physician, but then became the medical director over time. And I was there until the clinic closed.
Hey, and Tom, who are you?
I'm Tom Pittman. I was the executive director of Identity from January of 2024 up through our closure earlier this year. Lifelong Alaskan, born in Juneau, raised here in Anchorage.
Nice. Thank you both very much for being here. And before we get too deep into the show, I do want to let listeners know that we're going to be using a variety of different terms. Instead of saying LGBTQIA2S+, or a lot of other alphabet acronyms, I may often just refer to the queer community. It's a term that many have worked very hard to reclaim, and it is the one that I typically use myself. So, just to let folks know. So, Tom, I'd love to learn a little bit more history. Can you kind of tell me why history was started, why Identity was started, and why it was significant?
That's a wonderful question. Alaskans, I come in all shapes, forms, and sizes, and there's always been queer folk living in Alaska under different terms and different names, but many indigenous identities in Alaska have what we would now call a queer identity. What the precursor to Identity was a community center, and it was born out of a need for folks to have a safe place to connect and to find people who they could confide in, who they could build trust and support from. And Identity functioned in that crucial role all the way up from the late 70s through until its closure.
So, Tom, I'd love if we could start with learning just a little bit more about the history of Identity and what its significance was in Alaska.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I appreciate you asking me that. Alaska has always had queer folk living here. There's many indigenous identities in Alaska that have components of their culture, of their society that we would now give the term queer to. In the 70s, though, the precursor to Identity was formed to ensure that there was a resource where people could come together and create community, find people they could be themselves with, and build what we frequently call chosen family, people that we can rely on and can support us. And so from the late 70s, when the center was first created, all the way up through just recently, that was one of the primary functions that Identity held for Alaskans.
Okay. And then in recent years, it sort of shifted focus into more of a healthcare organization. How did that come about?
Correct. Yeah. So in 2015, a clinic was started called Full Spectrum. And that clinic was primarily serving the LGBTQ community, but it wasn't a nonprofit and was struggling. Small clinics in general are difficult to function. Healthcare is so complex, and a small clinic can really, it puts a lot of administrative burden on a very small team. So in 2021, Identity's board was approached by Full Spectrum to merge Identity with this clinic. And the board ultimately made the decision to have the two organizations merge. It was a controversial decision. There was a lot of deep discussion and debate, from what I know, from what I've heard from people at the time. But ultimately, Identity's board had decided that the needs, the healthcare needs of queer Alaskans was so great that we needed to make sure that there was an option. The reality is, and there's multiple studies that show this, that between 40 and 60% of queer identified people have avoided healthcare in the past due to discrimination or a fear of discrimination. And so Identities Board had decided that having a clinic was important enough that they wanted to resource it. And so Identity was attempting to run a clinic simultaneously to a community center from that point forward. Identity's executive director at the time, from what I understand, had shared that while he supported the decision, his background was in healthcare and he didn't feel that he had the capacity to continue as executive director. And so they had a planned transition for him to leave. And there was another transition briefly in another executive director. And then the organization went without an executive director until I had joined as a staff member in January of 2024. And in that period, the organization continued to try and run both the community center and the clinic. Unfortunately, though, again, complexities and expenses, the center that was located on Fireweed was closed, and instead, everything Identity became the clinic on Northern Lights. But we still had a lot of programming. In my first few months as executive director, we were working through books, our accounting, and what was opaque before suddenly became a little bit more clear that the organization had a very large deficit. And that large deficit in part was due to a larger staff. At the time we had 17 employees. And so we made the difficult decision, myself with the board, that we were going to need to end a lot of the programming that wasn't as well attended or as well patronized, and to focus more directly on Identity as a healthcare clinic. And so the majority of our programming from that point forward really faded away. We still had Transparent, which was a support group for parents of trans children. And then we also supported Alaska Rainbow Elders, which is a really critical organization supporting the social and other needs of queer elders in Alaska.
Okay. And Liz, how did you come to be part of Identity?
It's a somewhat funny story. So I had actually gone with one of my partners to a queer, I think it was, I can't remember what it was, some sort of like fair that was going on. And I walked up to the Identity booth because at the time I was, I had a job that didn't really kind of fulfill my needs, and I was looking for a new job at that time. I wanted something that fit my values better. And so I actually approached that booth, but Tom was not there that day. And someone gave me his email address, and I emailed him and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a new job. Are you interested in hiring a doctor who does family medicine? I also do addiction care." And Tom was a very, very busy man at that time, and he totally missed my email.
I did. For months.
So I continued on this path. I actually started working in Bethel, Alaska, as a hospitalist and obstetrician. And I loved that job and continue to work it. And I was still wanting to do something else in Anchorage, and particularly with the queer community. And so I reached out to the Queer Alaska Happenings Facebook page and said, "Hey, this is what I want to do. I was actually thinking about opening my own practice at the time. Is there a need for this in the community?" And I got a lot of messages back saying, "You really need to contact Identity and talk to Tom." So I tried again. But this time I was successful. So I met with Tom. We talked a lot about what my values were and what I wanted to do as a clinician. And we had a really great conversation that day. And that's when I decided to start working there.
Nice. So what were you trying to do as a clinician?
My goals are to provide comprehensive primary care for the queer community. I think it's really important not to lose the parts of primary care that often get left to the side when you're just doing gender-affirming care. And so there are a lot of folks who are doing gender-affirming care from other states, and you know, you can get it online, you can go to Folks, you can go. There are a lot of places you can go to get that care, but they're not providing preventive health care, comprehensive preventive health care, and that's really really, really important, especially for the queer community who might feel uncomfortable reaching out to another primary care doctor who's not accustomed to the queer community and might not be able to provide the care that they need. And so I really want to be able to provide really comprehensive care, but in a setting where everyone feels accepted when they walk in the door.
And identity was that place.
Yeah, it was.
You mentioned gender-affirming care. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a term we hear in the news a lot, but it'd be really helpful if you could tell us more, like, what does that actually include? What is gender-affirming care?
So I've been thinking a lot about how I want to kind of portray this. And I would say as we kind of feel that gender is on a spectrum now, it's kind of the general understanding that gender is on a spectrum. I would say that gender-affirming care is also on a big spectrum. So it can range from things as small as just acknowledging someone's pronouns and making them feel welcome and listening to their story, all the way up to people having surgeries for gender-affirming care. And there are a lot of things in the middle there. So I'll say a lot of what we were providing at Identity were medications to help people affirm their gender. And so we were providing testosterone so that people can kind of develop more in a male sense, and providing progesterone and estrogen so people can develop more in a female sense, and just kind of meeting our patients where they were. So, and I will say also a lot of people don't necessarily want to, you know, appear as a certain gender. A lot of people want to appear androgynous. And so there are hormone treatments that you can do that are, you know, lower doses, and just kind of working with the patient to get them where they want to be, rather than having the same protocol for every single person, because not everybody wants to end up in the same place.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm assuming this care also includes just a lot of conversations about who people are and where they want to go.
Yep. So my first appointment with everybody is just tell me your story, and tell me what your goals are and let me know how I can help you achieve those.
Nice. And so Identity began to fill this need and this gap. Tom, are there any like specific stories you could share from this time in Identity's history?
Yeah. So, you know, what Liz was saying about the importance of gender-affirming care within the context of basic healthcare, primary care, was I think one of the most critical components of what Identity Health Clinic had become. We also had behavioral health, and we had sexual health amongst that. You know, I think one of the stories that stand out to me the most was a community member who was deeply involved as a volunteer in another organization in the community that supported queer folk. And there was a moment where I was talking with her about this exact question, actually. Why is it that she felt that it was important to be getting basic health care from Identity? And in the dialogue with her, one of the things that she talked about is how she was from a culture and from a family that was incredibly supportive of her identity, of who she was, but that she hadn't grown up realizing that there was health care that existed that would be able to support her needs, that could help her navigate life more comfortably and more with more of her direct needs met, and that Identity was really that connection and that lifeline for her that made it so while she had wonderful social support, she could then finally have that clinical support, that medical support, experts like Liz who could help connect her with the tools that could help her be more of who she was and wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. And it seems pretty clear like what gender-affirming care is and kind of that very wide spectrum. But why is it necessary to have a primary care clinic that's accessible for the queer community? Is it just because of discrimination reasons, or is there more that goes into it?
I'd say it's yes, Anne, and I'm sure Liz could have some really good insights into this too. That one of my experiences, I've worked in healthcare throughout my career, and one of my experiences in healthcare that really made me realize how critical a clinic like this was, I was working in Juneau, and there was a provider in the clinic I worked at who had a trans child and was very understanding, very purposeful, very thoughtful in their care for patients. We had a trans woman early in their transition who came in and checked in for an appointment. And my desk was just behind the front desk. And the patient was brought back to meet with this provider. And I overheard the front desk gossiping and saying unkind things to each other after that patient was walked back. And for me, not being genderqueer in any way, and not having that lived experience, it was a moment where I had a window into the discrimination that folks face in healthcare and the lack of understanding and the bigotry that can make it incredibly difficult. That even when you have a provider who is committed to you, who understands you and has that cultural competence. And so I think that is a really critical component. But also, I think the other component for my part is that cultural understanding that primary care and gender affirming care, you know, even as a gay man at a clinic like this, working with a team, whether it's the front desk or whether it's my, you know, MA or whether it's the provider that are going to treat my lifestyle, treat my partner, treat the decisions that I make day in, day out as normal, and where I don't have to have in the back of my head while I'm just trying to talk about my asthma, is this person seeing me for who I am? That component is also, I think, really critical. And that has more to do with, you know, a provider and a team that either through lived experience or because of strong allyship want to understand me and what my needs are. But I'm sure Liz has more insight too into that dynamic between primary care and.
Yeah. So I will say I was trained in the military. I went to military medical school and then I went to a military residency. And then I primarily worked in military clinics. And I did not get a lot of the education that I would need to provide queer healthcare because of, especially the timing, because I was in the military during Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And there's a large amount of physicians in my generation that have not been properly trained to provide queer healthcare just because it wasn't something that their schools provide. And if they're not seeking out that education, if they don't have an interest in it, they may never learn these things. And so I think it's very important for queer people to be able to seek care in an environment where the people providing that care are very interested in learning and in acquiring the skills necessary to take care of their patients properly. And I think that is one of the big things about having, you know, a very queer-centered healthcare center, because you know that the people who go to work there are going to be the ones who are motivated to learn those things and make sure that they're providing anal pap smears for patients who need them, that they're doing comprehensive sexual health care, you know, sexual history screenings, and, you know, not having a shocked face when they get the answers that they don't expect. For me, it's, you know, being able to walk into a room and say something like one of my partners and not have someone give me side eye over that, which can happen, you know, in a clinical setting. People are like, what do you mean one of your partners? So I think it's really important to be able to have someone who's very receptive, who is not going to be shocked or appalled by anything that you say to them, and will support you in whatever you need.
So you mentioned specific training. Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of training would you suggest people get?
Yeah, so you really have to seek it out. There are a lot of really great resources online. I can provide you maybe with some links. I don't have things like off the top of my head. But I can definitely provide you with some links to things that I have sought out myself in order to learn more. There are a lot of really great conferences, and I'm struggling with the name of the society. We were talking about going to one of their conferences, and I'm struggling with the name of it. I'm sorry. Things off the top of my head, I'm not super good at sometimes.
I think I meant less like, here's a specific conference to go to, and more like, what are skill sets people should be looking for?
I think skill sets that people should be looking for are it really is kind of learning, doing the CME, the continuing medical education around queer healthcare, seeking out those resources and really intentionally learning those things. There are not as many, physical skills that you need. It's more just kind of an interest in discovering mm-hmm. the things that you need to know.
And cultural understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to take a quick break in our conversation, and we'll be back in a moment with more of Line One, Your Health Connection. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm Ann Hillman, and today we're talking about queer health care and sexual health with Dr. Liz Petralsik and Tom Pittman. So before the break, we were talking a lot about kind of what it means to go to a clinic and feel like you're not going to be shamed because of who you are. And that goes beyond just folks who identify somewhere on the queer spectrum. You guys also provided sexual health care for the entire population. Tell me a little bit more about what exactly sexual health care means.
Yeah, so for me, sexual health care means that you can go in if you have concerns or don't have concerns. Someone's always going to ask, are you having sex? More importantly, what type of sex are you having? How are you protecting yourself? Are you interested in getting more protection? And just really asking those detailed questions. The important aspects of that is if you're not asking what type of sex someone is having, then you may not be testing them appropriately for the things that they need. In particular, it's definitely possible to get gonorrhea or chlamydia in your throat or in your rectum. And those sites need to be tested if you're using them for sex. And if you miss those, then you might miss an infection that is in one spot, but like not in the urine or, you know, the genital tract if that's the only thing that's being checked. The other important thing about that is preventing disease. And so we did a lot of discussions around, are you having the type of sex that might put you at risk of getting HIV? If you are having that type of sex, then we need to talk about PrEP and we need to talk about ways to prevent HIV.
People who don't know what PrEP is, can you explain that a little bit?
So PrEP is a medication for pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. There are several different types of PrEP now. There are pills that you can take every day. There are shots that you can get every 2 months or every 6 months. And so these are medications that have been proven. They've actually been tested in relationships where one person had HIV and the other person did not. And so if we're giving these medications to the person who does not have HIV, even with unprotected sex, that disease is not being transmitted to that partner. So these medications have been tested extremely well. They're very, very, very good meds that work incredibly well to prevent HIV. And it's particularly important for the queer community to have access to these, but it's important for anyone in the community who's having the type of sex that could put them at risk for HIV to have access to these medications. The other part that is difficult with these medications is they're incredibly expensive. And so it's also important to be going to a provider who understands how to work those prior authorizations through your insurance to make sure that you're able to get the medications because they can be very, very expensive.
Just PrEP is expensive, or are there also post-exposure?
Yeah, so PrEP is incredibly expensive. And then there are also medications that we use if someone has an exposure to HIV. This could mean someone having an anonymous sexual encounter with someone who may have had HIV and not using protection, or the protection fails in some way. That person can then, if they need to be seen within 72 hours, which is a short time frame, and they need to be given a medication that they take for 28 days. And that medication can prevent them from developing HIV. And it's really, really critically important that we have that available in our community. And right now we don't, because Identity was one, I think, the only clinic in the community that was providing that medication for free. So we had samples of the medication that we would provide the 28-day supply to any patient who walked in who needed post-exposure prophylaxis. But if you try to get that medication cash pay, it's, I believe, somewhere over $6,000. And a lot of insurance, it will still cost about $3,000 to get the 28-day supply.
And so in theory, other clinics could offer samples.
They would need to get in contact with the representatives from that company that provide the samples. They would need to have protocols in place to make sure that they are appropriately testing when someone comes in for the post-exposure prophylaxis, completing the post-exposure prophylaxis appropriately. And preferably, if you have someone who needs post-exposure prophylaxis, you then want to transition into PrEP at the end of that. So you give them the 28 days of post-exposure, and then you start them on PrEP so that they don't have another event like this that requires the post-exposure prophylaxis.
Okay. And I want to know, it's not just the queer community that has to worry about this.
Absolutely not. Anyone having sex needs to worry about this.
And to that point, only 80% of Identity's patients self-identified as LGBTQIA2S+. 20% didn't identify that way. Most of those folks came to us out of a need for better support for their sexual health.
Okay. So there's clearly a need, and there's a need for the spectrum, like for everybody in the community. But Identity couldn't continue because of financial reasons?
Unfortunately. I had mentioned earlier about the complexities of a small clinic, and that was true of Identity from day one of having the small clinic, and it continued to be a challenge. So there was a myriad of things that was making it difficult towards the end, but the most critical, the most impactful was challenges with getting payment from Alaska Medicaid. We had a large stretch of time from December all the way through the decision that the board made to close, where the vast majority of the Medicaid payment that Identity was owed for the care that had been provided hadn't been paid. And Medicaid was one of our key payers. The majority of our patients relied on public assistance for their health care. Identity's patient base was a marginalized community. That's true of any clinic that's serving a marginalized community. That's what these tools are made for. But when the state isn't consistent with those payments, especially for small organizations, it's fatal to that organization. So that was the thing, unfortunately, that if there were one thing to point to, that would be the main thing.
Okay.
I will see that that's a reason why a lot of clinics, particularly small ones, limit the amount of Medicaid or Medicare patients that they'll take at any one given time, because they can't rely on those reimbursements, and so they know they can't stay open if they continue to take Medicaid and Medicare patients. We never had a cap on our Medicaid patients, so we would continue to take them, you know, no matter what. And that may have been kind of part of the fatal flaw, but it didn't seem right to not take patients who needed care.
It would have been counter to our mission.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's challenging to run a clinic like this unless you have some sort of major pot of money.
Yes.
So you can serve people a little bit needs blind.
That is true. That was something very unique about what Identity Health Clinic was. Nationwide, when you look at any community, the size of Anchorage or even larger, it's very, very rare that there's an independent queer clinic. Even in major metropolitan areas, the dedicated queer healthcare resources are affiliated with a large university or some other larger institution. There are some that are standalone, but typically they're at a much greater scale than Identity Health Clinic had been. That was one component that with the board we were working towards. The decision had been made that Identity could stabilize a little bit more if we were to work with another community of similar size and dynamic to Anchorage. And so we had been spending the 8 months leading up to our closure building connections with and planning for a second clinic that would be serving the community of Spokane, Washington. And then that way, with the patient base that Identity cared for here in Alaska, combined with that component of the Inland Northwest, we were hoping that we could have enough scale to weather some of the storms like massive delays in a Medicaid payment like we experienced. Unfortunately, though, like I said, there was a myriad of challenges, and especially with that fatal component with the Medicaid payment, we weren't able to get over that finish line before we just ran out of the ability to keep going.
So what happens for your patients?
So our patients, we basically put a call out to the local community, letting them know that we were closing and reaching out to see who would be willing to take some of our patients and continue to provide care for them. The interesting part of this is that we don't really have the ability to tell you on this program who those people are, because there are threats against our licenses for providing gender-affirming care, and there are...
To everybody or just to minors?
It has started with the threats to the licenses specifically were providing gender-affirming care to minors, but okay. I would not be at all surprised if that eventually stretched further. Like, okay. In this current climate, it wouldn't surprise me if it did.
So just to take a step back for folks who sure. don't cover this issue or mm-hmm. follow this issue really closely.
Yeah.
Tell me more what you mean, like there's threats to your medical license if you
sure.
provide care?
So there was, they drafted a...
Who's they?
The medical board, the State Medical Board of Alaska, drafted, I can't remember exactly what, like a...
You want me to?
Yeah.
You want me to
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So the Alaska State Medical Board made a resolution that they debated and then later passed that they would be able to revoke for gross misconduct the license of any license that they regulated, which is physicians and physicians assistants. Between the two, that's the majority of healthcare providers in Alaska, that they'd be able to revoke their license, calling it gross misconduct for following the standard care and guidelines from every major medical association nationwide. That hasn't taken effect because the way that these processes go is the medical board will have their resolution. It'll go into the Department of Law for review at the state, and then they'll make their determination. And it has been there ever since. And
since like 2024?
No, this was the summer of 25 mm-hmm. that this had happened. And so it's been sitting with the Department of Law, and if they to this day decide, yes, this is okay, that would go into effect, and it would make it so that way the majority of healthcare providers in the state of Alaska could not follow science-based, well-researched healthcare needs. That should be the decision of a parent with their youth, with their trained provider. That's where that should stay. Medical decisions should stay between a family and their provider. We're Alaskans. We deeply care about that autonomy, and that overreach of the medical board created a massive chill amongst the provider community. When Dr. Petrozic, when Liz joined Identity, it was such a critical moment for us because there were so many other providers in the community that had stopped caring for queer youth because of this fear that they would no longer have a livelihood and have to leave the state.
And so that chill is still happening in general with providers around the state.
Yes, and the other issue with that is that the federal government and federal funding through Medicare is put at risk by providing gender-affirming care, in that they are saying that if you're providing gender-affirming care to children within your facility. And so if you look at like a big facility, if they're providing gender affirming care to children in that or to minors in that facility, then they are putting all of their Medicare funding at risk. And so that's every hospital admission, everything. And so they run the risk of losing all of that care, of all of those reimbursements from Medicare. And so they've kind
of Medicare, Medicaid.
It's Medicare, actually. So Medicare and Medicaid kind of fall under the same umbrella. And so Medicaid is a state program. So this is Medicare funding in particular. And Medicare funding is, if you lose your Medicare funding as a major hospital organization, you can't function. And so there's a lot of risk in providing any of the care that they are saying that is going to put your Medicare funding at risk. So there's just a lot of obstacles. And then there's just a lot of general stigma, and folks are worried about their federal grants. They're worried about all of their funding. And so they worry that if they advertise they're providing gender-affirming care of any sort, then they're going to be putting that funding at risk. And so the folks that we reached out to who said, yes, we'll take your patients, also said, please don't advertise publicly that we're taking your patients.
Yeah. It's a reasonable thing if they want to keep their businesses going. Yeah.
And that is now the only option for our patients to receive care. And so I want all of those places to stay open and continue taking care of them.
So basically you had to speak to your patients one by one. And
quite literally, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And be like, okay, here's a person who will take you.
Yep.
That seems really disheartening.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And just because of the gravity of the emotional moment, I want to speak to what the community felt with this announcement that Identity was closing. For the patients at Identity, that vulnerable feeling of having to discuss with their provider how their resource, their stability, how that's gone. They have to get to know a new provider, develop trust with that provider. And by the way, they aren't going to be able to publicly talk about this critical thing that you need. But then more broadly, the queer community in Alaska, Identity has been for almost every queer Alaskan living, the rock, the bedrock, the foundation for the community. Whether you participated in a group or were a part of one of the pride celebrations that Identity had planned through the decades, Identity was a staple of your life. It was a hub of support and safety. The community was hurting when Identity had to make the tough decision of closing more of its programming, and earlier when it had closed the community center. The clinic was cannibalizing any and all other components of what Identity had become. And then in that final decision to close the clinic, Alaskans felt fear. They felt that vulnerability. They felt that anger. And amongst the many messages that the community were sending our way of gratitude and support, there was also so much fear and so much worry. And truthfully, in this moment, this Pride Month, many queer Alaskans are thinking through their safety and their stability and who they can rely on. What had created Identity, though, was a community that cared for each other, that built this because they wanted that safety and support from each other. That need is still very present. All the people that created that in the past and today, we're all still here. And even with Identity gone, one component that I was reminded of time and time again with those messages was all those wonderful people that created everything great about Identity are still here and still investing in the community, their time and their energy.
So are there specific community places that you can suggest people go? I mean, I know the Pride Festival's coming up, but beyond June.
Yeah, well, I would encourage anyone that is comfortable going there to go to Pride. There will be organizations there making sure that the community is aware of resources. And so please do go there. But outside of June, Alaska still has many wonderful organizations that are making sure that queer folk are taken care of. Choosing our roots is a critical component of support for youth in Alaska. And this is just to name a few: Planned Parenthood and ACLU of Alaska, both throughout the life cycle of Identity, throughout all of its changes, but especially in the closure, cared deeply about what was happening and reached out early and reached out regularly to coordinate and make sure that to make sure that the community was supported. Really, really critically, and an organization almost as old is 4A's, which is a social support system for Alaskans living with HIV and other STIs. And they continue to be a pillar in the community. They are the energy and the wind behind the Pride Run that'll be happening. Also, they are the sponsor of the Pride Festival. All of these really wonderful organizations are filled with terrific staff and volunteers that are very busy amongst this really challenging climate and environment, making sure that there are still resources and support. It's important that we all support them and that what happened to Identity isn't repeated in other components of what we need in Alaska.
So we've been talking a lot about organizations in urban Alaska. Liz, you work in rural Alaska. What are some of the options for people who live outside of the main urban centers?
Yeah, so I think there are probably, just like in Anchorage, there are probably a lot of providers who are willing to provide this care out in rural Alaska, but may not be advertising it. And so I think the best routes are, one, talk to your primary care provider and ask them if they know who in the local community is providing that care, and they likely will provide you with good resources. If you hit a roadblock there, I would say reach out to one of the organizations that Tom talked about earlier, and those organizations will probably be able to give you local resources for your rural community and where you might seek out that care.
And what if your primary care provider seems hesitant or seems to not really understand what you're asking for?
I think find a new primary care provider, because that's probably not the right person for you if that's the care that you need.
So people should just be willing to say no and understand that.
Be willing to say no. Every primary care provider, for whatever reason, is not going to fit with every patient, and it never should be considered any sort of insult to a doctor if someone says, hey, we're not a good fit, I'm going to go find another doctor. That's totally okay. You can do that anytime you want.
You can do that with behavioral health providers, too.
Yep.
I have to remember that. Well, thanks very much for those resources. We are going to take a quick break from Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media, and we'll be back with more conversation. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Just a reminder, this is a pre-recorded show, so we're not accepting any calls or emails. And today we're talking about queer health care and gender-affirming care with Dr. Liz Petrolczyk and Tom Pittman. Thank you again both for being here. So we've talked a little bit about kind of care in general. I think one of the common conversations around gender-affirming care and around queer care is talking about young people. And kind of what care is available for youth and minors. What care is available?
So again, I would say with the spectrum that we have, so there's a spectrum of care that's available. Some of that care is just a lot of it in the beginning is just that mental health care to talk through what that person is feeling, what they think that their needs are, be able to talk with their parents about options. And so there's just a lot of talking initially and not a lot of doing. And so just trying to figure out who your kid is, what they need from you, how we can achieve those things, and then trying to make a plan for the future. So as far as care available, when we start to reach the point where we're talking about medications, there are puberty blockers, and those are generally reversible. And so the puberty blockers have the really good advantage of giving you that extra time to make sure that this is the right decision for you and your child and your family. And then if you change your mind at any point, you can always just stop them, and then the puberty would come on just like it normally would. And so it gives it the gift of time there for these kids is really invaluable so that they can make the best decisions with their family for themselves. We would not start hormone medications on someone until we would expect them to already have been approaching and going through puberty. Usually that's around 16 or 17 years old. And so that's the time where we would consider starting testosterone or estrogen for a patient. Those require a lot of lab monitoring and a lot of really close and careful reevaluations just to make sure that we're doing the right thing for that individual person. And again, some of the changes that happen with those medications are not reversible. And so it's really, really important that we come to the decision that this is the right choice for that person before we start doing them. But a lot of the things that happen with those medications are reversible. So once you stop them, some of those things will reverse. And some people do change their mind, and that's okay. It's okay for someone to change their mind, and it's okay for us to decide this isn't the right route for you after all, and to just make sure that we medically supervise as they go off those medications if they need to.
So it's possible to change your mind, and it's possible.
It is.
As a medical provider, how would you encourage people to start this conversation with their parents or their caregivers or with their children if they're seeing something in their kids?
Yeah, I think that depends a lot on the situation that you're in. There are certainly some kids who aren't in a safe environment to have that discussion with their parents. And so the Trevor Project is a really good way for them to reach out online. You can go onto the website for the Trevor Project, and there's actually like a button, a thing there that I can't remember exactly what it is that you click, but it will immediately pull you out of it and erase the history. so that way, if you are in an unsafe situation, you're still able to look at those things, but not necessarily put yourself at risk for those people in your life who might not support you to find out that you're looking at those things. So I would highly recommend that for someone who doesn't feel safe. If you do feel safe, that's fantastic. and I, just recommend going to that safe adult and having a conversation with them and just let them know how you're feeling. And hopefully they'll respond with kind of an open and honest inquiry. And I encourage parents, if your kids come to you with this, to ask questions. It's okay to ask them questions, but understand that all of the answers that they give you might not be what you want to hear, but that's also okay. And the fact that your child feels that they can trust you enough to come to you with this should make you feel like you're a good parent, a really good parent. That should make you feel really good about what you've done for this kid. And so just make sure that if they don't feel comfortable talking to you, if they come to you and say, hey, I feel like this, but you're not the person I want to talk to about this, that you're also able to find them someone they can talk to.
And that also makes you a good parent.
Yes, it does.
Anything.
And so that can include someone like a therapist. That could also include your primary care provider if that person feels like a safe person to go to. I would advise that all parents, before bringing your child to that appointment, that you just talk to that primary care provider on your own first and make sure they are going to be a receptive environment. And if they're not, find someone else.
Mm, so talk to them before they ever meet
your kid. Talk to them before they ever meet your kid. Okay. Yeah. And that will limit you want to try to limit the amount of stigma that your child runs into in this process in the beginning, because it can become very defeating and can worsen the dysphoria and can worsen mental health conditions. And so you want to just try to limit. And that's not to say that someone shouldn't talk to them and say, hey, how are you feeling? And maybe even challenge some of the things that they're saying. You know, that's what your therapist, that's what a good therapist does, is kind of challenge you a little bit and say, hey, but is this really what's going on, or is it something else that's going on? And so you want those people in their life, but you don't want someone to be outwardly hostile towards your child.
Mm-hmm. I think one other piece of advice I'd have, if you are the parent or wanting to be that trusted adult, and you yourself aren't trans, you don't have any lived experience, what my advice would be is look at your circle and see if you have trans or queer loved ones in your life. And if you are thinking perhaps my child might be, make sure that you are getting close to queer people. Make sure that you are developing an understanding and empathy for what isn't your life journey, but is likely your child's life journey. That way, number one, you have someone you trust who you can talk to. And number two, you can see what a healthy, happy queer person is, and that will inspire you and help you as you raise your child to be that way. And honestly, that's good advice for anyone. Yeah. But especially true if you have someone who you care for who is coming out or might be coming out.
Mm-hmm. When you're in the beginning process of like trying to find care providers, what are questions you should ask? I mean, can you just ask the scheduling staff, hey, is...
I think questions you can ask up front. It's always okay to go into your doctor and ask them if they have experience in a specific area. So,
can you ask questions even before you get to the provider?
It depends. So it depends on how the practice runs. Okay. Some you cannot. And so a lot of places you will need to make that initial appointment and go in. But even in pediatric practices, it is not uncommon for a parent to go in for that first appointment without a kiddo. They do that for a lot of reasons, for a lot of them for mental health reasons. So if you're like, my kid's really struggling with depression, I want to make sure you're like the right person to talk to about if they need medications or anything. So it's not uncommon to do that. And that would be, your pediatrician should not bat an eye about that. But I think when you get there, just asking, do you have any experience with this? And then asking them very clearly, like, what is their experience? And do you think it would be appropriate for us to seek this care from you? Or do you think you would rather refer that care out to someone else? And a lot of times they will want to refer to a specialist, and that's okay, as long as the specialist is available in your local area. Oftentimes that's a pediatric endocrinologist.
Okay. And then are people also referred out to behavioral health specialists for these initial conversations?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So what kinds of...
Mm-hmm. Tom? I was just going to say, in identities model, that is where the conversation would always start. The behavioral health team would discuss and identify social supports if that youth had someone at school that they could rely on and trust. That, you know, just like what Liz was saying. And oftentimes, that might be as far as the care ever goes. Gender-affirming care can just be behavioral health. Only for some youth would it also go into medical care as well.
Okay. So what does behavioral health care for look like for gender-affirming care?
It's not that different from behavioral health from any other human. You discuss what your needs are. You discuss what your concerns are, and that trained professional helps guide you through it, helps you identify strategies, helps you identify supports and I'm trying to think of the right word here, but that behavioral health expert will make sure that you have every tool that you need, every resource in order to navigate whatever it is that you might be going through. And so for a trans youth, for their family, that discussion with the parents is talking about the needs of your child. And what is it that you see? Where is it that you are the most concerned and worried for them? Let's talk through that. And frequently, it's beneficial, again, for that to just be you and that therapist to go through that. And then, you know, there are times where it'd be most appropriate for maybe the whole family to be there with the provider and to talk through what the child might need and what, while the child's there, you know, what the parents might need to be doing or saying in order to support that child.
And we've talked a lot about kids. We've talked about adults. Are there gaps in care now that identity is
closed? Yeah, there are gaps in care, and a lot of those have been created by the federal funding issues, so particularly the Medicare funding, in that the Department of Health and Human Services basically came out with a statement saying that anyone who's providing gender-affirming care to minors, like they are putting their Medicare funding at risk. And so all of the places that rely on Medicare funding are not taking patients who are under 19 years old. And the 19 has to do with the Medicaid age of becoming an adult. And so if they're under 19, they're still considered to be a child under Medicaid. And so if you're taking anyone who is under 19 years of age, then you're potentially putting all of your Medicare funding at risk. And so there are many places who won't take anyone under that age. Although the pediatric endocrinologists, understandably, because they are trained to take care of children, are not wanting to take patients who are over 17 and a half, because those really should be taken care of by an adult endocrinologist. It's very, very hard to get into an adult endocrinologist in the state of Alaska. Your wait can be incredibly long, and I don't know that many of them are even providing gender-affirming care. And so there's that gap between 17 and a half and 19 that can be difficult to fill. There are some places that are taking 18 and over, and so we did discover that we ended up with a real gap between 17 and a half and 18. And when we closed, we ended up just giving people really long refills in order to get them through to that gap so that they could get care at the places that would take them at 18 years old.
So like 6 months.
Yeah, which is not, it's not my ideal to do that and not see those patients in follow-up, but it's also not reasonable to not do it.
Can people be seen over telehealth?
They can be seen over telehealth, and so there are some telehealth providers who are out of the state but licensed in the state, and they can provide that care through telehealth. A lot of it is cash pay. Some of them do take insurance.
Okay. And then, well, we're kind of talking about what options are available and what might be available in the future. Liz, it sounds like you're trying to come up with sort of a more creative option.
Yeah. So I am, as we talked about my goals of providing, you know, complete primary care, it is really, really difficult to do that in the American healthcare system because of insurance companies. Because of the way they reimburse, it forces us as primary care physicians to see a patient every 15 to 20 minutes throughout the day. That is not enough time to provide adequate care to anyone for anything, much less something as complex as gender-affirming care. So what I am doing is opening something called a direct primary care. And that is going to be a system where I don't take insurance. So it will be a cash subscription pay, a monthly fee that patients will pay to be able to see me. They'll have a certain number of covered appointments through the month and a certain number of acute appointments that would be covered as well, some labs that will be covered with that monthly fee. And then if they need things in addition to that, labs that are outside of the covered labs or additional appointments for any reason for the complexity of care, or if they just need extra acute appointments, then there'll be a small fee associated with that. But this is my attempt to be able to practice medicine the way I feel it should be practiced, when I can have 30 to 60 minutes with my patients that is uninterrupted, and be able to provide that care. But it takes out all of the administrative work of dealing with an insurance company, which is probably about 60% of what we end up doing in primary care, is just trying to deal with insurance. And if I take away all of that dealing with insurance, then I'm able to provide better care. But I still need to be able to, you know, make enough money to support my family, because I'm the, you know, I'm the sole provider for my kiddos. And so I need to be able to do that.
And so when will you be opening?
In September. So I think the third week of September. Yep, it will be called Found Family Medicine. We talked a lot about potential names for places, and a lot about just chosen family. Chosen family medicine seemed a little too religious, and so I went with Found Family Medicine.
Tom, do you have other bright spots, things that people...
You know, honestly, hearing Liz talk about what she's creating is a bright spot for me. It is incredibly encouraging to see wonderful providers like Liz who care so deeply about the wellness of Alaskans, of queer Alaskans, and are putting their energy and effort into making sure that there are resources. Healthcare in Alaska is incredibly difficult. We have massive shortages. Access is difficult. And so, you know, Liz, I think from the day that I met her, has been that bright spot for me. There are also many other wonderful providers in the community. Liz talked about how they reached out to us. They were behavioral health providers, primary care providers, specialists, who were all deeply concerned and worried about this loss for the community. And the reality is the majority of Alaskans working in healthcare want to see the queer community thrive here. And I think that's really incredible for queer Alaskans to try and remember is this moment feels very overwhelming, but the majority of at least the healthcare system, but even more broadly in the community, want to see us happy, want to see us thrive.
Any final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I just want to say that, like, I think that working at Identity was one of the most rewarding parts of my medical career. And I was very sad to see it end. And I hope that all my patients are doing okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I could add anything to that. Just immense gratitude, I think. The journey that Identity had was really challenging and really rocky. And I... despite it being so challenging for the community was also deeply concerned about those that were working at Identity. I'm really grateful for that.
I'm very grateful to both of you for providing care. Thank you to our guests, Tom Pittman and Dr. Liz Petralzik, who both used to work at the Identity Clinic in Anchorage. Thank you to our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can tell us your thoughts or suggestions by emailing line1@alaskapublic.org. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Thanks for listening.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.